am Will McHenry, and joining us today on this Ponars Eurasia podcast is Andrei Makarechev, a professor at the University of Tartu. Andrei, thank you so much for joining me for this Ponars podcast. How does Russia and the EU fit in the post-liberal or even illiberal international order?
Well, they play different roles in this allegedly post-liberal international order. But first of all, I think it's important to bear in mind that the whole idea of transition from liberal to post-liberal international order came from a very widely spread feeling that something went wrong with the consensus on the post-Cold War order, and something that was more or less obvious only 20, 25 years ago became much more problematic and much less functional in terms of foreign policies of many countries. So the idea is that we are not like witnessing a collapse of the order, but like a transition. And within this transition, the European Union and Russia, they really play different roles. The European Union is facing a number of domestic challenges. Well, with Brexit being one of the most evident manifestations of those challenges. And another challenge comes from those countries that have many doubts in the principle of solidarity when it comes to the refugee crisis, etc., etc. So that's a domestic set of issues. And in the meantime, the European Union also faces limitations of projecting its normative power beyond the European Union, especially when it comes to the post-Soviet countries and the Eastern Partnership Program, with its like 50-50 success rate is one of the illustrations. So Russia, in this context, is a challenger to the international to the existing liberal order, but it's kind of, I would say, it's reluctant challenger. So on the one hand, Russia tries to challenge the normative predominance of the European Union, the very idea that the European Union represents the whole Europe. But in the meantime, Russia also plays by the rule when it comes to other situations and other conflicts, like, for example, hosting mega events. In this case, Russia plays by the rules. And if you look at, for example, the doping scandal, Russia did accept all the rules and regulations and at least promised verbally. See what was going to happen. But at least in words, Russia does accept the rules of the game. So in this sense, Russia plays a double role. On the one hand, it tries to challenge the normative core of the EU, but in the meantime, also plays by the rule in other cases.
How has the post-Crimea crisis in EU-Russia relations changed such geopolitical areas as the Baltic Sea region?
Well, it changed me in many respects. It changed it in the sense that the European Union, for the first time, had to face a situation in a country which is institutionally close to the European Union. Again, let me refer to the association agreement and DCFTA and visa-free regime that the European Union has with Ukraine. But the challenges that this country faces are not about not only about people's mobility or institutions or free trade. It's a hard security challenges. And the European Union is simply ill-equipped to deal with those challenges, and I think Putin perfectly knows that. So he tries to set different rules of the game, making the European Union confront a situation in which the European Union just does not have sufficient tools for that, including army and clear hard security posture. So in this sense, that's what has changed. Another important element is that Russia develops a number of instruments and policies that have never been that important before. Well, one of them is a mobilization of Russian-speaking community, and there's a lot of literature on that. And the second track that Russia opened, well, relatively recently, it's connections with right-wing anti-EU political parties. Not just political parties, but some of those party leaders are already in power, like Matteo Salvini in Italy, his interior minister and deputy prime minister. So in this sense, Russia tries to develop relations with the European Union political communities, kind of bypassing or skipping Brussels for the sake of remaining important European actors. So we should not, overestimate this U-turn from the west to the east. It's basically a very performative act. Russia still wants to be European power, but in a different sense, I would say, and with a different hero. So that's the game that Russia plays.
How successful are Russia's alliances with European right-wing groups or nationalist conservative forces?
I would say it's very contextual, and we should not overgeneralize, because sometimes when you read literature, there might be an impression that all right-wing forces all across Europe are kind of Putin understanders or trying to, play Putin's game. This is not the case. It's just in a very limited number of countries that right-wing parties are really either align themselves intentionally with the Kremlin, or indirectly support Kremlin's rhetorics of foreign policy. This is basically the case of France, of Italy. Of course, it's Hungary. It's alternative für Deutschland in Germany, but this is not the case in many other countries. For example, in all Baltic and Nordic area, local conservative, national conservative right-wing forces, they are not among Putin's even potential allies. Let's take Estonia, for example. So in this sense, we should not overestimate Putin's ability to project its power and to recruit politicians and kind of certain part of political elites. But even I would say that even in those countries that are de facto ruled by coalitions in which right-wing parties play an important role, like in Italy, for example. Well, I would say relations between Salvini and Putin, it's something like an strange marriage, in the sense that Salvini did many, many things, just kind of inviting Putin for a real friendship. For example, he appeared in a T-shirt with Putin in the European Parliament. Then he was pictured a couple of times in the Red Square. He gave an interview to Dugin, probably thinking that this is one of the keys to the Kremlin. And the reaction from the from the Kremlin, I did some research on that. The reaction from the Kremlin, I would say, was very, how shall I say, constrained or very limited. And there are many reasons for that. One is that not many people believe, in Moscow, believe that Salvini can really make difference when it comes to the core issue. This is about lifting sanctions. They don't think that the investments in this friendship might, give some fruits. Then we know that not only Salvini, but some other right-wing forces are dangerously close to the neo-Nazi rhetoric when it comes to ethnic minorities, when it comes to migration. Well, for a country like Russia, who tries to brand itself as, the winner of the Second World War and the country that defeated fascism, well, that might be not a good type of friendship. Plus, some of these countries are Islamophobic, and domestically in Russia, being Islamophobic, that would be very problematic. So, I mean, there are always kind of, on the one hand, common frame and common denominator when it comes to, opposing or challenging the European Union. They might find some, something in common, but when it comes to wider array of issues, well, I would say that they have more, disagreements and disconnections with each other than a real, strong partnership. And of course, it's not about ideology as well. Moscow can play with far-right, left-wing parties. So in this sense, Moscow is like more, in Europe, more like opportunistic actor. So it just takes opportunities that are more or less available without caring too much about ideology, in my view.
Are there any new trends in the Kremlin's policies toward Russian-speaking communities in Europe?
I would say, again, the trend is that I think Russia tries to act on a country-by-country basis. Because, for example, policy towards Russian-speaking population in Germany, Russophone population in Germany and in Estonia are very different from each other. Again, I did some research on that. And even the way how Russian propaganda is translated to these relatively large groups of people is very, very distinct, very different. And in Germany a couple of years ago, we've had a first attempt to politically mobilize Russian-speaking communities just before the election, on the eve of election, and trying to make them an important resource of votes for a newly created right-wing party, AfD, which partly succeeded. I mean, many Russians indeed prefer to vote for AfD on the basis of, well, let's say, Moscow claim that Germany is becoming unsafe, that migrants are everywhere, they are doing violence and raping our girls, etc. So this type of rhetoric, it did play some role in this kind of reorientation of significant part of Russians in favor of AfD. In other countries with quite strong Russian-speaking population, like in Estonia, well, I didn't see any changes. Russia remains basically like a cultural icon for people, but there's very little that Russia does in practice when it comes to, I know, developing programs and projects that might somehow involve people with Russian-speaking background. The difference is that from the part, if you speak about Estonia, from the part of Estonian government, there is a change in policy, especially when it comes to the city of Narva, which is usually portrayed in the Western media as a very, I would say, securitized borderland with a Russian-speaking minority, and then you see all these parallels and analogies with Donbass and Crimea. So what the Estonian government does consistently during the last year, they bring many important cultural projects to Narva. They are behind the Narva's bid for European Capital of Culture in 2024, which is a very big deal. And they're trying to culturally open up to Narva with a very simple message. You can stay Russians and being European simultaneously. So this is not a problem of choice. You do not need to make choice, either or. It's not either or, it's both. You can be culturally and, I know, civilizationally, religiously, linguistically Russian, but in the meantime, you can also feel yourself and you can also be integrated into European cultural milieu, which basically defines your integration into Estonia and into Europe simultaneously. So in this sense, there is change from the Estonian part. I think it's a very smart move. Not all Russian speakers are happy to, how shall I say, contribute to this development, this new momentum, but I think it's quite strong, and that's the right thing to do, I think, in the future.
Andrei, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much for inviting
podcast.
Me. My pleasure.